Hi, and welcome to Zed Games. Recorded live at 4ZZZ Studios in Brisbane and broadcast nationally over the Community Radio Network, Zed Games brings you the latest gaming news, reviews, and interviews from across Australia and around the world.
Hello and welcome to Zed Games, heard live on 3ZZZ or around the country on the Community Radio Network, where we talk about video games. My name is Razor, and I'm joined by Miss Candy Payne.
Hi.
And Mr. Jody McGregor.
Hello.
Now, this week, we will be talking with a special guest. His name is Will Marks. He was the team leader on Stalker Shadow of Chernobyl mod Lurk, and he's here to help us unpack this big controversy over Steam's decision to start charging for mods. And then to suddenly stop. Exactly. So that's the hot topic in gaming at the moment, and Will will be helping us discuss that later on. But to get this episode started, I'd like to hand over to my colleague, Miss Candy Payne, for the week in gaming news headlines.
Thank you, Razor. Recently announced, horror game Silent Hills has been officially cancelled. The game was set to be a collaboration between Metal Gear Solid designer Hideo Kojima and filmmaker Guillermo del Toro, and would have starred Walking Dead actor Norman Reedus. An announcement by Konami confirmed the cancellation, but noted that the company was currently in discussions about launching a new Silent Hill project. The game's playable teaser, PT, will be pulled from the PlayStation Network store this week. Shortly after the announcement was made, Konami voluntarily delisted itself from the New York Stock Exchange, reportedly as a cost-saving measure.
All this trouble within Konami seems to stem from a falling out between the key team member Hideo Kojima, who is of course the creator of the flagship Konami title Metal Gear Solid. Not sure exactly what's going on there. I don't think we'll hear too many details about it until well after the release of Metal Gear Solid 5 this year.
Yeah,
but Jody,
several years from now, we'll find out what
exactly
happened.
But Jody, you are a fan of the Silent Hill games. You've written an article or several articles about the game series. What do you think
of
this?
I love the series and was looking forward to seeing what Hideo Kojima and Guillermo del Toro, who is the guy who directed movies like Hellboy, and it was a pretty exciting thing. I'm still going to look forward to whatever Silent Hill game they churn out next, but I suspect, given that they just delisted themselves from the stock market to save $5 million, it's probably going to be a much smaller and less ambitious one than what we were hoping Silent Hills would have been.
Insider reports, so anonymous sources, say that Hideo Kojima and several of his like key collaborators will be leaving the company at the end of this year. That's going to be a huge blow for the company, right?
Yeah, and they're taking his name off Metal Gear Solid 5, which is like, isn't that what you do in Egypt when the pharaoh dies and you get rid of his name from all of the monuments? It's like, they're just erasing him from history now.
Yeah, it seemed like it was too good to be true when it was announced. Like, all these huge stars working on the Silent Hill game, I guess that was the case after all.
Yeah, it was all a dream.
Aww. EA has altered the refund policy of games purchased through its digital distribution client Origin by Australian customers. Previously, the buyer had a 24-hour window after launching the title to seek a refund. Under the new policy, the buyer can request a refund at any time if the game is found to be faulty. The new policy will exist alongside the Good Game Guarantee, where players can get a no-questions-asked full refund within 24 hours of launching the application.
Sometimes we forget how great Australian consumer rights law is until it bumps up against the laws of other countries. And it turns out we actually have like really amazing laws for, you know, ensuring that consumers get the best deal and get refunds on things that don't work. That's not nearly as guaranteed in other countries.
Yeah, it's among the best in the world, I think. I found out firsthand because my PlayStation 4 keeps malfunctioning and the controllers as well.
Really?
Yeah, and they'll just give you a new one.
Yeah, well, I just walk into my local games retailer and just hand it over, say it's broken, and yeah, they gave me a new one, no questions asked, basically.
No questions asked, because a customer is always right.
That's right.
Call of Duty Black Ops 3 will feature the option to play as a female soldier, a first for the popular first-person shooter series. Campaign director Jason Blundell said that Mass Effect's protagonist Commander Shepard, who can either be a man or a woman depending on the player's choice, served as an inspiration for the decision. The campaign will also feature a four-player co-op mode and a two-player split-screen co-op mode. Black Ops 3 is scheduled for an early November release. An update this week for the console version of Minecraft will add a female player character to the game. The game previously featured a variety of skins for the male protagonist, nicknamed Steve. The new hero, Alex, was introduced to players of the PC version last year. Marvel and Telltale Games have announced a partnership that will see a game series released sometime in 2017. It was not revealed which characters the games will feature, but Marvel Games creative director Bill Roseman said that they will be authentic, sexy, eye-popping, and exquisite.
Now, I think that while Bill was talking there to the journalist, maybe like a really attractive Black Widow cosplayer was walking past in the background, and those are the words that came out. But no, seriously, I'm like a huge Marvel fanboy and loved Telltale's games, especially the comic book adaptations, The Wolf Among Us and The Walking Dead. Mm. So I'm super excited to see what they're going to do here. The only sucky thing is that I'll have to wait until, 2017?
2017. Sometime 2017.
Why would you even say it now? Like, that's too far in the future.
I know, people will forget, I think. Or just be super excited for too long.
What comic do you want them to make into a game, Ray?
I'd like to see a Spider-Man something or an X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think they are really good at those big, hard moral choices. And I guess an X-Men game would be full of that kind of stuff. And Spider-Man is guilty about everything. Just so, yeah, that would work.
Maybe the first decision you make is like whether to let the robber go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the one that goes off and kills your Uncle Ben, and you can, like, totally change the course of Spider-Man's history with that one decision.
And it's just your own conscience haunting you. Spider-Man will remember that. I'm Spider-Man. What?
Alrighty, that is it for the weekend gaming news headlines. You're listening to Zed Games. Now, last week, PC gaming giant Valve, the operator of Steam, which is the world's largest digital distribution service for games, announced that they would begin selling mods through the Steam Workshop, beginning with The Elder Scrolls V Skyrim. Backlash from the player community was swift and brutal, and this week, Valve announced that they would be reversing the decision and fully refunding anyone who paid for mods. So joining us in the studio right now to help us discuss the topic is Will Marks, who is the team leader on the Stalker Shadow of Chernobyl mod Lurk. Will, thank you very much for joining us today.
Good evening.
Let's start at the beginning for the listeners who aren't so well-versed in gaming tech speak. What is a mod?
Well, mod is a short for a modification. You could describe it, say, as a player plays a game, they find something which they think can be changed, and if the game has tools available to them, then that player can then go into that game, change what they want, and create either an entirely new experience or maybe just a slightly adjusted one, depending on their preferences. The modding community is rather huge, actually. It's become a subculture over about 20 years or so, born out of the hacking community. And yeah, I've been a part of it for about 7 years now. Hmm.
Skyrim is an interesting subset of the modding community, because the Elder Scrolls games, for a while now, Bethesda's been releasing the SDK, the Source Developers Kit, to encourage modding, because they know that there is such a dedicated community. And obviously there's a commercial value in that, just because people modding the games makes more people interested in them. It keeps the discussion about them going. And also it means that if you're annoyed by something about the game, you can just get in there and change it, or find out that somebody else has already changed it for you.
Right, yeah, of course. What you're referring to is a creation kit, which was released initially with Morrowind and then Oblivion and Skyrim, and Bethesda definitely kept that going because they found it prolongs the life of every game they release.
Yeah.
So which other games apart from Skyrim have mods as a big selling point?
Well, there's also Stalker Shadow of Chernobyl, as you spoke about before, which I worked on. But other than that, there's many titles. Even the Call of Duty 4, the Verse Modern Warfare, had a huge modding community. Several other titles which are escaping off the top of my head, but you usually find that games which tend to open up their source code, not their source code, but say the source of the game, their game files to players, they tend to become attract the modding community over time. Another one that comes to mind is another Bethesda title, which is the Fallout 3, Fallout New Vegas titles. Hmm. They have huge modding communities based around the GECK kit, which is similar to the creation kit for Skyrim and such.
I got into mods with Quake, which had a huge modding community, and even entire games grew out of that. Team Fortress 2, and the original Team Fortress was a mod for Quake that impressed Valve enough to get them to design their own game as a sequel.
Dota as well was a mod of Warcraft 3. So, you know, Valve themselves have profited a lot off the modding community, right?
Yeah, of course.
And Counter-Strike was originally a mod for Half-Life.
So last week when Valve announced that they would be charging for Skyrim mods, there was, to understate it quite a lot, there was a very vocal outcry from the gaming community. A large portion of those people think that the mod should be inherently free. Will, do you agree with that?
Do I agree with the people stating that, or do I agree with the concept they're putting out?
Do you agree that companies shouldn't charge for mods at all?
I disagree with that notion. The reason being is that many great games, as you said before, have actually come out of mods, like Counter-Strike, Garry's Mod, huge one comes to mind. But I think what happened with the Bethesda controversy was the execution was terrible, to put it lightly. It came entirely out of left of field, and the way that they were offering distribution, for example, the pay card, the pay distribution, and how they handled content rights regarding mods was rather terrible. I think that's what most of the controversy was based around. I mean, there was a vocal portion of that controversy which stated that mods should be inherently free, but I do disagree with that notion.
What do you think the rationale is behind Valve's decision to suddenly start charging for Skyrim mods?
Well, Valve has been working on community content for a long time now. Like, for example, with Team Fortress 2, you have community-made hats, community-made weapons and such, and they found that to be rather successful, and the communities did adopt it rather quickly. When they approached Bethesda about it, I think what happened was that some kind of communication breakdown happened in the negotiation process between Valve and Bethesda, and it just ended up with what we have today.
Some people were angry about the revenue that the creator of the mod would take, only 25% of the total purchase price, whereas Bethesda would take 50% and Valve would take what I think is their customary 25% cut. That doesn't seem very fair to me. What's your take on it, Will?
Well, it's a bit difficult to quantify the value of mods. For example, with Team Fortress 2's hat and weapon system, the creators of the models, the assets, get 25%. 75% of it goes to Valve. But when it comes to, say, game mods for Skyrim, it can be an entirely different beast. A lot more work goes into it, say, than just creating a hat. So then the question becomes, how do you quantify the value, say, of a huge mod which changes the entire game compared to, say, a tiny mod which adds, say, one weapon or something? So,
yeah, some of the mods that I've tried for Skyrim have been massive. There are some that will do things like change the AI for all of the enemies in the game to make them harder or more realistic, and there's one called Falskar, which adds like an entire new landmass that's full of new characters and new storylines, and was obviously an incredible amount of work. That was one where the creator of that mod later got a job at Bethesda because he so impressed them with that creation. And yeah, as you're saying, that's a much bigger investment of someone's time than making hats or guns for Team Fortress 2.
Do you think people would be as disgruntled if all of the profits were going towards the creator?
I think that, yes, some of the controversy would have been subdued if that was the case. Obviously, it's unrealistic to expect Valve or Bethesda to donate all the profits to the creator because they are providing the distribution channel.
Yeah.
But I think that was just one facet of the controversy, and a lot of different people had different objections to the system, so...
Do you think that part of the outcry was due to the fact that maybe Valve was opening a door that they didn't want to see opened? Like, just charging for Skyrim mods would mean that all mods one day might be a paid-for-only service?
Well, I don't really believe in the slippery slope argument, but given Bethesda's history being sort of a frontier of game microtransactions, for example, if you guys remember the controversy that surrounded the Horse Armor DLC in Oblivion, that for its time was a rather huge uproar in the community, but now, as you see today, we have DLC for a lot of games and it's become pretty much accepted. So I would have been interested to see if it was executed properly. I would have been interested to see how that would proceed over the years and see what other titles sort of adopt that model.
Yeah, it'd be nice to think that if something like this were to work, that it would attract more companies into making their games more open to mods, that would mean there were more companies releasing creation kits as a way of encouraging people to mod, because we've seen in the past Sega Creative Assembly's Total War series has had a lot of huge mods for the older games in the series. There was one for Total War Medieval that reskinned the entire game as a Warhammer game, taking all of the historical units and turning them into fantasy units, which is exactly what Sega Creative Assembly are doing with the next Total War game, which is going to be an actual licensed Total War Warhammer game. But it would be nice if companies like that were encouraged to get back into making their games open to modders.
Yeah, I think Bethesda went into this with very good intentions. For example, in the initial statement, when they found out about the controversy, they released a statement essentially saying that they wanted to encourage people to experiment in mods and get into the modding community. For example, they said that only 8% of people who play Skyrim have actually used mods. So they were definitely looking to increase that sort of portion of the market into the modding community.
There wasn't really much lead-in or no lead-in whatsoever to the decision to pay for them. Like, it was just like, okay, today you have to pay for mods. Do you think that this was due to the fact that if they had of maybe given people warning, they would have like gobbled up as many free mods as they could beforehand?
It's hard for me to think about that rationale that Bethesda had for keeping it all under wraps. I know that they've had this in planning for about 3 months now, and the mod makers who were initially in on it got contacted personally by Bethesda to prepare their mods for the marketplace. But I think the reason why, if I had to guess, they kept it under wraps was because, yes, they didn't want people to, say, go out and grab those mods before they went up for sale. But ultimately, I think that would have been a bit of a futile gesture anyway, what they've done, because the mods are available pretty much anywhere you want.
Valve does have a history of doing things very suddenly and without warning, of just sort of like dropping a bomb and then seeing what happens, which hasn't backfired for them quite as harshly in the past. They are a weird company in terms of community management, because it really doesn't seem like there's anybody listening to you. If you have a problem with the Valve game, actually getting someone to talk to about it at support is kind of a nightmare. It seems like it's a historical failing of theirs that they don't understand they need to tell people about things.
Yeah, the lack of communication they have kind of worked for them in the past to build their mystique, I guess. But, you know, today's age is very different. I mean, if you're doing something that's going to affect a large amount of people and no one knows about it, what is your excuse? I mean, because you can tell people over social media, there's a million channels, a lot of channels you can use to inform your customers about stuff. So if you're not doing that, then why aren't you doing that?
Even Steam itself was a bit of a surprise to a lot of people. When Half-Life 2 was first coming out, nobody really knew about Steam's, Half-Life 2's requirement to have Steam installed until basically the day before it was released. So there was a lot of controversy surrounding that as well, I remember, but now Steam is obviously very widely accepted.
We've been talking about Steam's decision last week to allow people to charge for the mods for Skyrim that were previously available for free. And we've been talking a lot about how the players have reacted pretty negatively to that. But Will, as a maker of mods yourself and as part of that modding community, what's the reaction been like from the other side of the fence?
Well, from the position of a mod maker, someone who actually contributes to the community involved in this scandal, I suppose, is been very mixed. There's been quite a bit of support for the concept of paid mods. Like, for only in a program I said, but quite a few mods have come out which have been paid, which turned into, you know, very successful games. But a lot of mod makers seem to agree that the execution was flawed. But one sticking point I found, which was rather major in the modding community itself, was the issue of asset ownership regarding mods. In a modding community, it's very much accepted for mods to sort of interbreed, cross-pollinate, I suppose you could say, sharing assets amongst each other. Usually the only stipulation is that whoever takes, say, a portion of a mod and uses that in their own mod to make something else gives credit to the original owner and so on and so forth. But when the issue of money came into it, that got thrown for a loop, because the question then comes up, which is, you know, who gets paid? How do you distribute money amongst all the people involved in providing assets for a mod? One of the prime examples was a phishing mod for Skyrim, which got taken down from the marketplace a day after the market went up, over an animation used in it, which was provided by someone who wasn't actually involved in the mod team, but released as part of, say, a free content pack for modders to use. And once that dispute happened. The mod got taken down by the original creators, an apology was issued, and that became even more of a question amongst the community, I think.
Actually, this kind of sort of leads into a point that Razor and I were just discussing before the show. This is fairly uncharted territory for me, to be honest. But my understanding with mods is that you kind of get the tools and the templates to go and create the sort of addition to, you know, a game that may have been released a number of years ago. But there's kind of no other control over what you're creating. Is that correct? So essentially somebody can alter or drastically alter the game that was originally released, which may have been released like with a, I don't know, PG rating or something, but could quite significantly change it. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's entirely correct. The modding community is very much anarchistic, I suppose you could say. A lot of people, there's a lot of mods out there which could be considered just kitchen sink mods, which take assets from like 20, 30, 50 other mods, put it all together in one compilation, you can play in that. That was actually very common for Skyrim and also Stalker of Shadow of Chernobyl.
Now, I've heard, but I haven't, obviously I haven't actually directly seen it, that there are nude mods for Skyrim. That's a good example of a mod that would drastically alter the content, maybe so that it wouldn't be able to be released in that form.
Yeah, well, obviously, when you have an anarchistic society, you get a lot of interesting things coming out of that. I use interesting in air quotes here. But yeah, there's a lot of examples, say, of games which, after release, got re-rated, actually, because of mods that came out. A famous example would be Grand Theft Auto San Andreas, in which a mod was released which unlocked some hidden content with the game, content which was scrapped before release to preserve a lower rating. I believe you're all familiar with the hot coffee scandal. So, yeah.
So now that Valve and Bethesda have kind of fumbled the introduction of this paid mod situation, do you think that harms maybe the idea of introducing them at a later point?
I think it's sort of... well, it's really difficult to say. I don't think this will be attempted again for a while simply because of the backlash and the amount of money which Valve actually lost. Gabe Newell released a statement saying that the amount of email traffic coming into their servers costs them millions of dollars compared to the $10,000 they made off the marketplace during its lifetime. So I definitely think it's made a lot of publishers, a lot of distributors very scared of the power of the angry consumer, I suppose. But I would definitely be interested to see it happen again in a more controlled form. I'd definitely be interested, say, if Bethesda approached the modding community and asked them what they'd want to see in a marketplace if they were to release one.
I think it's really admirable that they reversed the decision so quickly. I mean, they only introduced the idea last week. There was obvious consumer backlash, and then they've revoked it. So, I mean, I have to take my hat off to that, at least.
Yeah, definitely. But I can't help but feel that Valve maybe felt like their hand was forced. As I said before, they were losing a lot of money from it. It was something definitely they didn't expect. So I don't think it was particularly done out of goodwill. It was done simply because it became a huge net loss for them.
I see. Let's talk now about your mod that you made for Stalker Shadow of Chernobyl. The mod was called Lurk. What motivated you to start work on that?
Well, actually, I came into the project, I guess you could say halfway through. It was originally made by a man named Holden McClure. He started the mod as sort of a compilation pack for a lot of fans of Stalker Shadow Chernobyl. The original release was in 2009, and after that was released, he decided that the mod needs to take off on a different path and become a sort of its own thing instead of just a compilation. So we started on Lurk 1.1. I came in about that time after the initial release, and I started working alongside him. We brought on a whole bunch of new people after that, and we released 1.1 in 2010. After that, we had plans to release Lurk 2.0, but as we went on development over the next 3 years, we found that just the toolkit we were working with was so obsolete and out of date at that point, and poorly localized because Stalker is a game originally made for the Russian market, that we eventually just abandoned production entirely and switched to our own project.
So what were some of the changes that Lurk made to Stalker? Because it was a pretty big and comprehensive mod, right?
Yeah, I'd definitely say it's one of the bigger mods out there. What we were basically aiming to do with Lurk 1.1 and Lurk 2 was get a lot closer to, I suppose you could say, the inspirational material for Stalker, which was the books Roadside Picnic and the film Stalker by Andrei Tarkovsky. we felt that Stalker didn't quite portray the emotional state of those inspiration materials. So we took steps to sort of rectify that in what we thought was the best manner. So, for example, we increased the difficulty. We introduced a lot more atmospheric effects. We worked a lot actually on the audio and music too. So, yeah.
Stalker, for anyone who isn't familiar with it, is a game set in Chernobyl, but one in which these strange physics-breaking alien anomalies are sort of replacing the radiation as a danger, and people called Stalkers have gone there to harvest, I guess, to scavenge alien technology that has maybe slipped through from another dimension. So you're wandering around in this barren Russian wasteland, and at any moment another stalker could shoot you, or one of the packs of rabid dogs could eat you. It's a very tense game, but at the same time, it is a game from 2009 that maybe hasn't aged well. I can see why it's one that's popular with modders. It's the kind of thing you can see what a great game it could be.
Some mod creators have become, I guess, very successful, more successful than they would have thought of when they first started working on the mod, maybe even going on to work for the companies of the games that they were creating mods for. Like, a good example is, like Jody said earlier, the guys who made the Quake mod called Team Fortress, who eventually became Valve employees. Was that something that was in the back of your mind when you were working on Lurk?
Definitely not. Basically, the reason for that is that the company GSC, which made Stalker, is based in Ukraine, and none of us lived in Ukraine at the time. And not only that, but the company, the company also folded soon after the Fed release, went into basically a comatose state. But what we were really enthralled about with Stalker was just the community that sprang up around it. I don't think GSC expected the English market to take it up quite as enthusiastically as they did. So there was a huge modding community based around it. Ironically, one of the game's faults, which was it was extremely broken and made from a mishmash of different technologies, became its strengths, because that flawed nature of it actually opened up the engine to a lot of modifications. So a lot of people came and fixed what they could, and a lot of people took that material, changed it, and it's even one of a huge undertaking called Lost Alpha, which aimed to restore a lot of the cut content from the game. That was released, I think, about last year, and it was actually originally meant to be sold on the Steam as well. But because it got leaked by one of the team members, that never happened. He just released it for free.
What does Stalker stand for? I keep saying, like, I've looked it up, and it's an acronym for something.
I don't remember off the top of my head, but I recall it stands for Scavengers, Trespassers, Anarchists, Looters. I'm really putting you on the spot here.
Killers.
Yeah.
Close enough. Well,
environmentalists.
Ecologists, that's it.
Ecologists.
And then R is...
Raiders?
Ruffians? I don't know.
Rascals.
But basically, I think really that that acronym really meant that they just wanted to use the word stalker.
Yeah.
So...
So you mentioned before that you've got a new project in the works, something you're working on with Unreal Engine 4. Is this something that's grown out of your work on Lurk?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of the same people who worked on Lurk with originally moved on to this new project. So it's called Sodus. It's based essentially on a spiritual succession of the work we did on Lurk. We're trying to aim a lot more closer to one of the source material, which I mentioned before, which was Roadside Picnic, a book. And what we're essentially aiming to do is not quite recreate Stalker, but sort of make the game, I think, that we all sort of wanted originally when we played Stalker. We're sort of a potential in it to make something great. So, yeah, that's basically what we're doing.
Cool.
Well, Will, thank you very much for joining us in the program, and thanks for your insight into the modding community and also your views on the Steam paid mod fiasco that's happening right now. Yeah. And when can we look forward to this new project that you're working on, and how can we keep tabs on it?
Well, it's still only in development, so we don't really have a release date, but I expect to make a media announcement within the next few months, and I'll keep you guys updated on it if you wish.
Cool. Awesome. Thank you very much. Now, Candy, you have been playing a game for your mobile, is that right?
Yes, that is right.
Sorry, I forgot what it was called.
Oh, it's okay. It's called the It's called The Silent Age, and I don't even remember how I stumbled across it, or I think it's a couple of years old. The reason I downloaded it, the first chapter is free, and I think the second one, if you want to continue the story, is almost $7. So I thought I'd give the first free chapter a go. The reason I downloaded it to start with is because I actually quite liked how the art style looked. It's just kind of a really basic, flat... it looks 70s because it starts set in the 70s, but there's just not... whole lot of detail in people's faces and things like that. It's just really simple style, all very bold colours and things. So anyway, I've downloaded this game called The Silent Age. Essentially, the storyline in this game is that you are a simple Joe no-name cleaner in a giant company with, you know, 25 stories high, and they're doing some secret work down in a laboratory that you've never had access to before. One day you get called into the big boss's office and told that your previous janitor boss is no longer working for the company. You've been given a promotion, no extra money, but great, get back to it. You've got a whole lot of responsibilities. So you get yourself an access card and you go down to the laboratory downstairs and you start seeing like drips of blood and things like that. This is not a gory game. I should explain, the way you play this game is actually... it's an all music background and all text comes up on the screen. So you get, it reminds me of that old game that you used to play on the PC, The Haunted Mansion.
The Choose Your Own Adventure kind of.
Yeah, it's,
text
yes.
Adventure
yeah, what was
thing.
That, you're guys?
About Hugo?
Hugo and the Haunted. Yes, that is exactly what this reminds me of, just far less pixelated. I'm not kidding, that's exactly what this is. So it's
And don't forget about Penelope.
Penelope was my favourite. You always had to rescue her from like the crazy witch doctor.
But she had her own spin off game.
She did, yeah. Well, anyway, we'll talk about that next week because I love it. So, Silent Age, you play as Joe. It's kind of a point-and-click thing, so I got it on my phone, which is fine. The screen is actually big enough for that to work because you're really only picking up one thing at a time. You have to, first of all, follow the trail of blood. You go to report it. That's very good of you, honourable, blah, blah, blah. You then get the keys to go into another room downstairs, and there's this crazy old man rabbiting on about a whole bunch of scientific words and things I didn't understand, and I didn't care to replay the text because... yeah, whatever. It was science words. I didn't get it. He hands you what you discover is a time machine. Anyway, you take that, you walk outside, all of a sudden cops have been called and you're arrested. So it's still not in early 70s. You're arrested. The next scene, you know, you're kind of being interrogated in the police room. And then you remember you have this funny green device, which is a time machine. And it suddenly transports you. You hit it because it's glowing and it transports you to now, where... I don't know what has happened, but everything is decrepit and falling apart. There are skeletons everywhere. It's still not like a scary looking game, you know, because they keep it pretty safe. And he makes a lot of really wisecracking, i.e. lame dad jokes about the skeletons being there, because naturally in a point and click thing, you want to touch everything to work out if there's a clue behind it.
So obviously.
I'm pushing the skeletons and he's like, oh, touching a skeleton. When did you become such a sick person, Joe? And I'm like, well... it's just weird text. Anyway, so this is kind of the game. You have to work out what's going on, why the world has fallen apart. A couple of episodes in, you realise, maybe it took me a little bit too long, but I realised you actually have to start bouncing back and forth between the years to travel through things. So in 1970, a door might be locked, but you travel forward into the future. Suddenly that apartment door doesn't exist anymore because it's fallen down in disrepair. So you can get inside the next room. Then once you're inside that room, you might need to travel back to the 70s to find if there's an object that you need. So it's taken me a while to get my head around remembering to travel through time to collect really basic items like a glove or... a serviette.
It reminds me of a game that I used to love as a child, Day of the Tentacle.
Yeah.
Had that time-traveling mechanic. Yeah.
Only with three different time periods. That was confusing. Are the puzzles hard?
It's not that they're hard. I have become a little bit stuck with one. And I think it's to do with remembering where you last saw something and then going back to just try and work out how you can open things. Like, it's very simple to words on how, it's very simpleton instructions on how to get through things. You know, like you come across a drain pipe that is a sewage cover that's closed. So naturally you try and open it. Oh, you can't lift that. You know, traveling forward in time hasn't given you muscles, Joe. Good one, Dad. You know, so then you have to go and try and find a wrench, and then you'd think the wrench would work it. And oh, that wrench is still rusty. That's not strong enough. And I think, oh my God. So you just spend so much time looking for, then he gives you another clue. Maybe it's a tool that you would never expect. Like, well, okay, clearly. So it's that kind of, it's not that it's hard. It's just a little bit frustrating how many times it makes you walk back and forth through the same scene, but in different years.
It seems like an interesting genre for a mobile game because you have to rely on your memory a lot, it seems, with this game, like remembering what you've done and all the items and stuff. Whereas in a mobile game, you want to be discouraging that sort of thing because, you know, one minute you're playing, the next minute you're on the bus. Mm. 4 hours later, you whip up the game and you can't even remember where you were.
Mm.
So it seems like maybe that could be a bit of a failure in that regard.
Yeah, I don't know how... Yeah, it could be. I don't know how much longer I'm willing to stick it out. I mean, I was hoping to at least get through to the end of the chapter and then decide if I wanted to pay more to find out what happens. Because essentially, you know, you've travelled 30 years into the future, 40 years, whatever, and there's suddenly the human race is not there anymore. So I'm intrigued enough to find out what causes apocalypse. But, yeah.
Okay, so it's a free game where you have to pay to get the ending? Is that what
you're
telling
much.
Me?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, I've been playing it for a few hours already, so...
It's like a free demo.
It's a free demo, but the demo's going a lot longer than I thought. I actually thought it would have stopped a while ago. So, I mean, that's nice. And then you can buy the second chapter for about $6.49 or something. So I've got it through one of my own iOS. So I actually didn't look to see if it's on others, I'm sorry. But if you want to have a look, it's The Silent Age. I do quite like the art style. It took me back.
And the music is a big component of it, right?
It's not huge. I mean, it's nice enough to listen to. Like, it recommends that you play it with headphones, and I don't get annoyed by it. And it's got some cute sound effects and things like that. But, it's not a massive, massive part of the game. Nothing to write home about.
Cool. Thank you very much for your thoughts on Silent Age.
Yeah,
Candy,
no worries.
Available on iOS, possibly other platforms that Candy didn't... look into.
Sorry, boss.
That's all right. Okay, that's going to bring us to the end of this week's edition of Zed Games. Thanks, everyone, for listening. It's been a pleasure. Now I just have to say goodbye to Jody, who is leaving us for overseas for a few weeks. Jody, very excited for you, but unfortunately you won't be here for the next couple of
weeks.
Where
are you going, Jody?
I'm going to South Korea.
How handy that you've been playing that game Influent and learning Korean.
But the rest of us will be back next week at the same time for more gaming-related antics. Catch you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.